Thank you guys so much for joining us. We've got John Stephens, the CFO of AT&T. Hopefully, the most consensus long. We'll see what the poll says. I don't know. So let's kick it off with talking about DirecTV.
Okay.
You've got a big deal that seems to be approaching closure. And a lot of questions, I think, about strategy, what it means for AT&T, what it means for video generally, and how you think about sort of over-the-top versus what people say is a quote-unquote legacy technology.
Great. So first of all, Mike, thanks for having me here, and appreciate the audience and appreciate being here. Secondly, let me start off with my standard safe harbor. Some of the comments today may be forward-looking. Actual results may vary. With that, we'd ask you to refer to our website and our future SEC filings for further guidance. With that, checking that box, we're extremely excited about the DirecTV deal. As we said, and I've said many times, we still expect it to close in the first half of this year, which means in the remainder of this quarter. We remain optimistic about that. This provides us the opportunity to really change our company. We now will be a national video player, a national wireless player, a near-national broadband player. And so it'll give us an opportunity to remake our company. It'll also give us some interesting assets, along with our Nextel and Uscellular acquisitions, give us some additional very interesting assets in Latin America, and gives us an opportunity to diversify in a very prudent way into different revenue streams. So from that perspective, we're very excited about it. Specifically with regard to DirecTV, we get an asset that generates great cash flows, has less capital intensity than our traditional business, and fits very well with our core business. If you think about it, DirecTV's got the finest, not only products and services, but some of the finest employees and capabilities in the industry. They face one real challenge. They don't have a broadband product to bundle with. If you look at our 57 million broadband locations, soon to be 70 million, one of the challenges is there's 30 million, soon to be 40 million, that we don't have a video product to bundle with. On the day after the deal, we're going to have those assets. We're going to have that national broadband, and near national broadband, and national video player. That combination is very exciting for us. It gives us real opportunities. We believe that we ought to be able to make this free cash flow accretive on an immediate basis and get to EPS accretive very, very quickly. If you think about the cost synergies that we've talked about, $2.5 billion run rate 3 years out, we're very optimistic about being able to meet that target, and we're working very, very hard to be able to beat it. And I'd also point out that that does not include any revenue synergies, which we think is a real opportunity for us. So all in all, we're very excited about it. With regard to what it does for us on content, it immediately makes us a player of size. We suddenly go from being, in the AT&T side, a customer with 6 million video customers to being the company with the largest number of video customers here in the United States with 26 million, and almost over 35 million, close to 40 million worldwide. So that gives us a very significant standing point and gives us that opportunity to help create that over-the-top opportunity, to be able to utilize our vast distribution assets, those 75 million postpaid wireless customers, virtually most of which have either tablets or smartphones and have great capabilities to accept data and video. And then, as I mentioned, the 50 million broadband connections we have today that we don't sell video over. So it's a natural play. You may have seen the announcement that just came out that we just signed a deal with Hulu to distribute some of their services over our wireless platform and through our website. And so we're optimistic that we can do transactions like that in the future, more of them, and further that allow us to take what we can provide to the marketplace, that great distribution platform, and continue to support the over-the-top marketplace. In short, we become a player and a significant player in that market right away.
So I guess, John, can you talk a little bit about this sort of legacy versus new technology and people thinking about over the top? And in our view, there's a discussion between technology versus a la carte. When you think about over the top, DirecTV has a lot of content, clearly. They seem to be able to provide the same thing that most of these other guys do at probably a better price point. So how do you evaluate that and think about whether it's millennials, over the top. How is DirecTV positioned, you guys?
I think it changes our position from a traditional AT&T, where now we have this great connection with millennials, with all customers on the wireless side, these great capabilities with broadband, but they immediately bring all this content with them and these relationships with other content providers. We believe that the linear, the subscription model, the DTV model has a very long life. We think it's going to be more, as it is in my home, it's not the, one or the other, but rather it's a both. And we believe that that ability to deliver both and have those capabilities on a near national basis is going to be a differentiating factor for us, and ability for us to work within the content ecosystem, the customer ecosystem, and our network ecosystem to really deliver quality products that work for everybody.
I guess when you think about the economics of a customer on DirecTV versus the current AT&T U-verse, how do you think about CapEx, installation costs, what it means on a going forward basis for where you really direct your attention?
Yeah, so I think on an installation cost, the big issue is when we do a broadband and video combination, the installation cost of a one truck roll, if you will, regardless of whether it's the, in our in-region, whether it's our great repped workforce that does that installation, they now can do both at once, and we think that can be very efficient. Much cheaper than it's been done in the past by the two separate entities, or whether it's done by the DTV outsourced network out of region where they can go in and do both. So, whether it's a fixed wireless local loop and a satellite video stream. So there's natural efficiencies there. With regard to that, we'd expect to get the U-verse content, so to speak, rate card to the DTV rate card as those contracts, current existing U-verse video contracts mature. We think that'll occur relatively quickly and relatively optimistic of not being able to get that, so that content will be the same. So we'll be able to provide customers choice in what they want to do. I think that's the biggest issue there. But the, if you will, being able to provide a bundled broadband and a bundled video with one truck roll on installation, with one customer care call, with one bill, with one advertising and promotion and sales budget, are really positive things and really drove a lot of the increase in our cost synergies that we raised from originally the $1.6 billion last year to most recently $2.5 billion run rate.
So talk a bit about the increased synergies. Obviously, you have a lot of confidence there. The driving forces there you just mentioned, but thinking longer term, the margins of that business, how you think about video, your content costs, how does it all sort of flow through to margins?
Well, I think it's, from an immediate perspective, I think you see in our filings, the biggest challenge in our U-verse video business today is content costs. And we immediately get some savings and get an ability to get a path to those savings from this transaction. There's been different estimates of whether those costs are 20 or 25% higher than what some of the other players in the industry can get. But if you will, the math is pretty clear that it's going to have an immediate impact. Longer term, this gives us that opportunity through greater scale and content to have much better negotiation arrangements. Our cost synergies don't include increasing at this time, don't include dropping the rate card further below what DirecTV has today. But you'd expect as you grow and you have different distribution points for the content players that they might be interested in providing some incentive for you to offer those to them and expand their footprint and get more efficiencies. On a margin basis, as we said, the longer-term wireline margin target for us is to get back to the 30% margins as we go through not only this transaction, get more efficiency and more sales penetration of broadband, but also go through our Project Agile initiatives and cost-saving initiatives. We believe we can do that over a period of time.
So, I guess thinking about DirecTV, what does it do for AT&T's broadband product? You've got U-verse, obviously, and you've got fiber nodes, and I think 18 million, is that right? Or
so we've got 57 million IP broadband locations,
okay.
And there's just under 30 million of those, about 29 million, that we don't have a video product for today. So when you're looking at the market today, whether it's DirecTV not being able to bundle in owner's economics with broadband, or us not being able to bundle in those 29, nearly 30 million locations with a video product, immediately we get to bundle. We have owner's economics. We can get the noise out of who takes the discount, how do you commission it, how do you install it. That is a tremendous growth opportunity and establishes a new competitor in a marketplace where, in many situations, there may not be much competition for the consumer to choose from and to take advantage of from a bundled broadband and video perspective. That's a huge point for us right there.
Sure.
If you go into a couple just other things, like, for example, we have 2,300 or so company-owned retail stores. DirecTV doesn't have any. We don't sell a video product out of, you know, about 1,000 of those today. But after the transaction, we ought to be able to get to a place where we can sell DirecTV on all 2,300. That's a huge opportunity to expand the service capabilities of that great satellite product. And as you know, they've got the satellites up there. The efficiency of that satellite distribution system is great. And we can add a lot more customers without necessarily changing the necessity for more capacity in that satellite space.
So, I mean, how does it change the current AT&T Uber space if you think about video being carried hopefully on satellite? Speeds could increase. We could see less CPE spending.
Yeah, a couple of things there. I mean, we'll go through this in time. We'll let customers make choices about what they want. But if you've got a broadband pipe into your home and you've got both video cars and data, and so to speak, data cars on that pipe, on that highway into your house, and you take the video and you put it off onto the satellite, it's going to take traffic off the pipe. And by doing that, it's going to, you know, it will improve it. If you do that for another home, it's back in the backbone of the network. You may ease the capital requirements or the CapEx and expense requirements in the backbone from that. But we're going to let customers decide what they want and where they want it. That focus is what's important to us. So those are opportunities we could get to. And quite frankly, it's just about bringing quality to the customer choice.
I guess we'll throw a CapEx question in.
Sure.
VIP spending's come down, obviously.
Yes.
As you think about the fixed wireless build that you've talked about, how does that sort of unfold? And as we think about, you know, not maintenance CapEx, but sort of what's the real run rate of CapEx that we should be thinking about for AT&T? And if you could, sort of bifurcate between wireline and wireless.
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, we have taken our CapEx down from most recent years in the $21 billion range. We came to everybody in 2012 and did our Project Velocity IP announcement and said we were going to refresh the network. And we suggested at that time, I suggested at that time it was going to take 3 years, and we'd have elevated spend in the $22 billion range. Our spend actually came down in the first 2 years in the $21 billion range, and the big change to that guidance was that this year was going to go down to 18. And the reason for that is because our network guys outperformed. Our network guys got the job done. We have 308 million POPs of LTE capability that's running great, high quality, high speed, high reliability. We've got 57 million broadband locations that have high speed capabilities, IP capabilities. And while we're not quite to 1 million business customer locations passed with fiber, we're at 800,000, and or about 800,000. So we've accomplished faster than we had originally estimated what we set out to do. So it's natural that you'd come down on CapEx spending because they got the job done, and they did a great job doing it. With regard to the $18 billion, if you look at our revenue streams last year, about $132 billion, if you back out the equipment revenue, then the handset sales revenue, you come down to about $120 billion in revenue. A 15% capital intensity would get you to an $18 billion number. That's how we think about it. That's where we think the spending ought to be. With that being said, we are starting to see some real benefits of software-defined network and to the efficiencies of a fully integrated carrier. So when you have the, you know, backhaul capabilities because of your legacy wired and pipe business, so to speak, and you can interconnect that with your needs for backhaul for your towers and your wireless business, there's a lot of efficiencies. So we do see a path to getting it below 15% capital intensity. Right now, for 2015, we're at that $18 billion range, and we'll work real hard to continue to keep these great networks up and running at this high quality level, but we do see an opportunity for lowering that. With regard to the split, we don't generally give the detailed splits between it. It's gone from 60-40, 40-60, depending upon what build is going on. I will tell you, the real challenge for us is to efficiently integrate them. So whether I call a Ethernet to the cell site a wired asset or whether I call it a mobility asset, the important piece is getting that Ethernet to the cell, getting it backhauled into my IP backbone, and using the network efficiently. I would suggest to you, though, we are proud of the quality of our wireless network, but we understand how important it is to maintain it, and we do believe that network leadership is important in a competitive world, so we're going to work really hard to keep the quality status we have. We know how important it is. Likewise, if we continue to have some of the demand that we've seen in strategic services, we will fund capital for demand-oriented, revenue-based generation activities. With all that being said, we still expect the $18 billion range for this year.
So I guess if you could indulge us with a sneak peek on an analyst day that I presume is going to happen. Hopefully the deal closes soon and we can do that. Just thinking about, not the specifics about what you might announce, but thinking about strategically...
I was going to give you all the specifics. No.
I was waiting for them. Mexico,
yep.
DTVLA, how do you view those assets? Are those strategic to AT&T? When you look at DirecTV, domestically is generating a lot of cash flow. DirecTV Latin America has had some challenges. How do you sort of evaluate the risk, the opportunity, and what is going forward in that sort of Mexican and Latin American opportunity?
Yeah, so the Mexican opportunity, we're really excited about it. If you think about it, we had just a few years ago a kind of $8 billion investment, passive investment in the Mexican and Latin America mobility market. We've converted that to cash and now reinvested about $3 billion of cash and assumed about $1.5 billion of debt. And now we have a fully 100% owned operational mobile asset. It covers virtually the entire country of Mexico. Out of that, we've got one of the leading spectrum positions, and we've got an opportunity to really take advantage of the blending economics that go between Mexico and the United States, whether it be the cultures, whether it be the people, or whether it be business. So we're very optimistic about it. If you look at the economy down there and you look at the Mexican situation, we've got government regulation that's very positive, that's encouraging investments like ours. We've got a marketplace that's underserved today, not only from an LTE perspective, but from a smartphone perspective. And it's not only underserved compared to the U.S., it's underserved compared to many other Latin American countries, so there's a real opportunity for growth. We see economies that are really tied together. The Mexican economy is actually growing faster than the U.S. economy. And we've got a unique situation where, because of the regulatory environment, there is a need to rebalance the customer counts amongst the providers. So all of that gets us very excited about it. Our management team down there is very capable of overseeing a process over the next few years will really dramatically improve that network. Remember, we're going to get a lot of great spectrum. We're getting a lot of great towers and capabilities. We need to do what we did in the United States with 300 million pops of LTE. We need to replicate that process in Mexico for a much smaller footprint, and we believe we can do that. And then we'll see the benefits not only in the customer growth in the Mexican market, but we really believe that there's a lot of customer growth opportunities north of the border for the U.S. customers who call down there, whether for business or personal purposes. So we're real optimistic about that. On the Latin American DTV operations, we view the transaction really as focused on the U.S., on the great people that we're getting, the great capabilities, technical, software engineers, as well as marketing and content relationships we're getting out of the U.S., the great distribution system. We view the Latin American operations as a real optionality, a real opportunity for us. We'll wait till we get, if you will, the deal closed, and we'll dig through that. It is a very interesting opportunity, and yes, there are, it's a different marketplace. There's some challenging times in some of the locations, but with it being said, we'll wait till after we get the deal closed to get some time to dig in and really evaluate it. Right now, we're very pleased with where the deal stands with regard to the assets we're going to give the United States and the ability to provide customers choice with a bundled opportunity here in the country.
And just finishing the loop on Mexico, I think some investors are concerned about, you know, capital spending, and obviously we're not going to get word today, but hopefully soon. What do you think about the build-out requirements, or not requirements, but build-out to get a good product, and your relationship with AMX? Like, how do you sort of view that marketplace? Is this a big risk for AT&T as you enter that market?
Yeah, I mean, we really view it as a very, you know, it's very good timing. Regulatory perspectives, we've been welcomed. If you look at the timing of the transaction approvals for both the Nextel Mexico and the Eutelsat deal, both of those deals were announced, you know, and approved in a very short order. So that aspect of it has been positive. The growing economy and the ability to serve those customers is really optimistic for us. If you will, the CapEx is going to require some CapEx. But quite frankly, with the, you know, opportunity to utilize emerging market conditions and opportunities and to incent vendors to participate with us, we feel very good about it. It'll be a, you know, it'll be an important number, but in the scope of AT&T and the $18 billion kind of run rate that we expect to have this year, it's something that's extremely manageable. So we feel very, you know, very good about it. And it's unique in the sense that there has to be a rebalancing. There's economic incentives for rebalancing of the customer base amongst the providers, and we feel very good about being able to participate in that rebalancing.
Well, hopefully we get news soon on that.
Yes.
So let's talk about the operations. Wireless. A lot of concerns, I think, on the competitive landscape.
People concerned about the best ever first quarter churn? Is that what they're concerned about?
Something like that.
Okay.
Or handset adds. And you're not alone. I think you're making a smart decision by sort of pulling back on promotion and pricing and doing the right thing. But as you look at the landscape, how do you think 2015 shapes for yourselves and just think about the industry? How competitive will it get in the back half of the year?
Well, I think it's going to stay competitive. I actually, some of the, in some markets, or in some aspects, there's more noise than there is bite, but there's always been competition. I'd suggest to you we feel good about where we're at. We're being prudent about our pricing and promo decisions. We continue to hold on to our, you know, 10 gig, $100 price point. We think that's important. We think that's a place to market. We continue to see customers buy up to 20 gigs in bigger buckets. So that's been encouraging. The churn, very seriously now, for the full year last year and now five quarters, for this first quarter this year, we've had record churn. So we're able to compete in this environment. More importantly, with regard to the makeup of our customer base, I think it's really important to note that we had 1.2 million smartphone adds to our base customers. Now, granted, much of those were conversions from feature phones. They weren't new customers, but they were customers, if you will, stepping up, both on the prepaid and the postpaid side. So customers are not only voting to stay with us, a low churn, but they're also upgrading with us. And so we feel very good about that our plan is working. With regard to the rest of the year, we're optimistic about it. I think the key thing is we announced Mobile Share Value Plan in the first quarter of last year, so we'd had some tough comparisons throughout last year and through the first quarter. We're now going to lap that process with regard to the second quarter, so we feel much better about those comparisons and what the rest of the year is going to look like. That's going to help us. Additionally, we've had three consecutive quarters of sequential ARPU growth on our postpaid customers when you take into account both service and monthly, what they pay us on a monthly basis for the equipment. And we would expect that to continue and get us to a point where we have year-over-year growth soon. We haven't stated a quarter yet, but we hope that would be soon. So from that perspective, we feel really good. You get into, you know, the number of connected cars, you get into the interconnection of our business wired and wireless services what we're selling to our largest business customers, and you can really build some excitement about it. It's a tough, and it is a competitive market, but our team's doing very well, whether it's on the postpaid side or whether it's Our Cricket business has done very, very well. Churn's coming down, adding smartphones. And quite frankly, they're nearing a 5 million customer base. We're at or near that level right now. So that's been a tremendous accomplishment for the team. So we're real proud of that.
So I guess thinking about connected car, connected home, it's something that I think some of us think is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
AT&T, I think, used that differently. As you look at the opportunity, what is the ARPU coming out of that? When you think about home security, connected home, connected car, what is the revenue opportunity you think that AT&T can generate there?
So the ARPU is on the digital eye for the connected home. Vary by what you buy. Simple packages are the $30 to $40, depending upon what you connect with. You fully automate the home, adding in devices that are, you know, water sensors, meter reading, all aspects of security, cameras, glass sensors, so on and so forth. You can get into, you know, multiples of that over, you know, certainly over the $100, $200 range. And depending upon whether your insurance company provides a subsidy for that, you can get we can get a larger ARPU that can be offset by their insurance savings. That business, we're growing carefully. We're growing with step-by-step process, but it's doing well. And we think that's a real opportunity. The overall security industry is very bifurcated, very disjointed. We think the opportunity to have a national standard, a national quality carrier do it is still very, very attractive. With regard to the connected car, it's a process that starts with first getting your equipment in the car, getting the relationships with the manufacturer. So if you think about the, you know, some of the larger auto manufacturers that might be located in Detroit, you're selling them pipes for their connectivity. You're selling them security services, strategic services. Now to be able to sell them something that goes into their cars, that the product they manufacture, it's just natural. So that's been a real positive for us. They get the information being able to whether upgrade the software remotely in those cars once they're on the street or whether to monitor the engineering performance of that car. Those are really important things. And those things are going to develop over time as we and the industry learn to use the talents better. Once that goes to the dealer, then the dealer has the opportunity to communicate with the owners of those cars for marketing opportunities, whether it's oil changes, whether it's upgrades, whether it's information with regard, whether it's updating the maps. Things that can be done in the middle of the night when our networks aren't very crowded and we can distribute that information. Once again, it gives us another connection with the business side of it. But then lastly is once these cars are bought and they're on the roads and once the promo time that dealers or manufacturers often give the purchases of the car the first 3 months free, customers then get to realize what that value is worth and we can add them to our mobile share value plans for $10, kind of like adding a tablet. Now, they get real successful and they start using it, they may buy a bigger bucket and we may actually get higher ARPUs out of it from not only the kind of adding it to your mobile share value plan for 10 buckets, but also buying a bigger bucket. Additionally, we can have prepaid customers. We can have customers that aren't on our mobile share value plan who buy one of those cars, can just buy a relationship with us for that car or for that capability. We're optimistic about the ability to do that. We developed some technology to do this in the aftermarket, so for all the cars that are out there already. And then lastly, we can do it if you're riding in somebody else's car, you can plug into their Wi-Fi hotspot and use that and pay a fee for that. Those other revenue opportunities, those retail revenue opportunities are going to develop over time. But when you think about it, in the next 3 years, we'll have 10 million connected cars out there with our capabilities, and that's from an original equipment manufacturer perspective, not the aftermarket. That'll be extra. But if you think about having that and having the ability to sell into that base, we are very optimistic about it, and we do believe it is also going to help bring that whole ecosystem to an AT&T customer that's going to help with churn. So all aspects of our process, it's going to take some time, but we think it's worth it. In the meantime, the CIOs who work for these large companies are pretty happy with the ability to deal with one provider who can do not only strategic services and security, can connect their customers to the websites and provide security on wireless phones, their employees can connect, but also that they can install that kind of great quality connection and reliable service within their products and services. I'll take it back. Our network guys did a great job in building an LTE network that is high quality, high reliability, high speed. It enables us to do these kinds of things. That's why it was so important to spend this that money and that time in getting these quality networks built. And we're real proud of them and real optimistic about the opportunity to use them going forward.
So let's move on to AT&T Next and EIP, which I think for the industry and in my business, it creates a lot of confusion, I think, frankly, on modeling. But from your perspective, was this the natural progression? You know, people pay for their handsets basically in full. You've got an installment plan. They've got free financing. But you know, thinking about AT&T generally, and we talked last night about ARPU trends, you know, when does ARPU sort of stabilize coming through this whole process? How important was it for AT&T with a high percentage of iPhones in the base to move to an EIP type platform?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Yes, I do believe that the ability that EIP provides to give customers choice, but also to give very, very direct clarity into what phones cost and to give them that opportunity not only to bring in, you know, not only to choose their phone and pay accordingly, but also quite frankly to bring their own phone. We saw a million phone increase in bring your own device last year. For 2014 compared to 2015, we had a million customers come to us with their own device that they'd already paid for and add it to our network. That doesn't bring me any equipment revenue, but doesn't bring me any equipment expense either, and some high quality customers. So yeah, we do believe that this is that ability to be clear with the customer on what things cost and how they impact them was really important. Two, if you will, because our phones were of the higher quality and the higher expense, it brought clarity to what our service packages really cost compared to other providers who may not have been providing those high quality phones. So it makes it much more comparable about what our high quality network for a 10 gig plan costs versus what some others, because we don't have the inclusion of a high quality, high cost device included in that. And that's really been important in a competitive sense. I think that's really been important in keeping our customers educated and allowing them to make decisions to stay with us. I think it's part of the churn. Plus it puts the natural economic situation where consumers are starting to manage the economic infrastructure there of handsets and the cost of those equipment. All of that's been good. From a cash flow perspective, we invest in a lot of money. We have a total, as we've said publicly, about $5 billion of customer-related, equipment-related receivables in total on the balance sheet at the end of 2014. So that, and most of that grew in 2014. So when you look at our free cash flow last year, that certainly impacted it. That was a known investment we made in our customer base. If you added that back to our free cash flow, we would have had a phenomenally successful free cash flow year. If you look at our bad debts in last year and in the first quarter, you'll see that our bad debts remain at very, very low rates. We make this investment with high quality, high credit customers. It's worked for us, and once again, it shows up in our churn as well as many other places. So we believe that that's the right decision. If you want to talk about ARPUs, it's already growing. When you take into account service revenue ARPUs plus the monthly amounts we bill for Next, we have three quarters of sequential growth. And as I mentioned before, we'd expect year-over-year growth to come soon. We're not giving a quarter on that. But we are pleased with the Next process. We'll probably invest $4 this year as that base continues to grow, and then level off and get back to more normal processes in 16 and 17. The investment in the customer base this year, I would not expect to be anywhere near as large as it was last year, but I do expect it to grow.
Yeah, it might be early, but people sort of think about, as those equipment payments come down when you pay off the phone, does the customer embellish or like enjoy the fact that they're paying less per month, or do they go out and run it and buy the next iPhone? And how does that affect your view on the EIP program generally?
So first and foremost, if customers do hold on the phones longer and they're happier with their service and they have economic benefits, maybe they'll buy bigger buckets, maybe they'll use more of our services, that's fine with us. If you will, from an experience level, from our assumption perspective, we started doing the equipment installment program in July of 13. So we've been doing this for about a year and a half. our initial programs for a 12-month plus trade-in cycle, and they did not come with a discount from the service revenues. What we've seen so far is customers are holding on to those phones longer than we would have expected. But it's still very early. The higher volumes of equipment installment plans that we had that we sold really came in the end of the first quarter last year and throughout the end of 14. And so we'll learn more as we go. But so far, customers have held on a little bit longer. One of the interesting things for us is that we do have a large iPhone base, and in prior periods, the cost of those devices and the refresh cycle of those could provide some challenges or some strain on our financials when upgrades came up. The uniqueness of it now is they have some of the highest trade-in values of any phones, so when customers do bring those phones back to us, we have less economic risk with regard to those phones because they hold their value so well. So from our perspective, it's kind of a shift in that dynamic. It's become what was a challenging situation before has become somewhat of a benefit to us today. Additionally, we have over half of our equipment installment plan customers buy insurance from us. And so we have a natural use for those phones that are traded in to go through that, our fulfillment cycle with regard to our satisfying our insurance requirements, as well as wholesaling them across the world because of our worldwide standard, and whether we can effectively utilize those in our prepaid markets or in our Mexico market to help jumpstart the smartphone growth down there. We're continuing to work on those kinds of things. But so far, the trading cycle has not been a challenge for us from a value perspective. The phones have been a little bit longer. We're very happy. If the customers are happy, we're happy for having them hold the phones a little longer.
So let's talk about the boogeyman. And I focus a lot on consumer credit and credit worthiness and the shift of prepaid into postpaid. And it's been dramatic. We wrote a report about it. But thinking about AT&T specifically, and I think you and your peer Verizon are very careful about these things, but how should we think about the amount of credit being given to the consumer? And is there a risk as an industry that we're doing something that we shouldn't be doing over a period of time?
There maybe is a risk as an industry, and I'll leave that to the people in this room to decide, because the industry, across the industry, there are different standards. In our case, as I mentioned, and the thing I've heard keep pointing to is our free cash flow statement, our bad debt charges that are there, and you can see significantly, historically low levels of bad debt write-off across our business. So we're seeing very good results. Secondly, if you look at the ability for us to securitize with these large banks our equipment installment plans, you'll see that these are really high-quality receivables because we've got eight banks that have put up a commitment of $500 million apiece, willingness to fund, and they're taking our equipment installment receivables. I would suggest to you others may not have the same experience when they do that. Some might, we'll see how it goes. Some may not have done it because of that, but ours, we're seeing a very good experience. We haven't changed our credit standards through this process, so we feel very good. Alternatively, we went out and acquired a platform and a company with extensive distribution in Leap to launch the Cricket brand. So we have an alternative to serve those customers who may fit a different credit profile. And we have an alternative to fit those in a very effective way. And that has been a very successful program for us, but doesn't have the same credit situation, but not the same credit risks because of the differences between EIP. I would suggest to you, others are just not in that situation. We're also not doing the let's get a customer by giving away $650. That hasn't been our approach. And I would suggest to you all of those things do give the industry some additional risk, but individual players who continue to be prudent and focus on profitability, I think should be painted with that same brush.
How should we think about costs in the wireless business? I mean, we've talked about VIP spending coming down, so wireless CapEx presumably is part of that. But just thinking about cash costs in the business, thinking about EIP and what that means for subsidy, and longer term, what should we be thinking about? Clearly, price compression on the ARPU side from moving into these EIP plans, but it would presume at some point in time we should see some lift on the lack of subsidy?
So what the elimination of the subsidy costs are if you will, moderation. The management of that subsidy cost is significant. Second, data growth continues to be extensive. So we had 50% growth in average handset usage year over year, and so we continue to see people buying up to now. We used to talk about 10 gig plans. Now last earnings call, we started pointing out the growth rate of 20 gig plans. And we'll get additional monetization with that. Third, as part of our Project Agile initiative, we have done a lot of things with, for example, digital first, which is the ability to order, revise, pay, and transact by our customers on their laptops, on their through a broadband connection, or on their mobile phones. We saw a 10 million transaction increase last year from a digital perspective, and we'd expect that not only to repeat, to grow. That's allowing us to do a lot of call shed, a lot of increase quality and efficiency, get customers back online quicker. Those kinds of activities, and there's very many of those going on, but those kinds of activities are going to continue to provide us the opportunity to stay competitive on pricing, but to grow margins. Lastly, the one thing that we have that's different than others is we have an extensive network of cell sites, whether they be towers or others. In prior years, that's been some challenges with regard to the costs associated with managing those. But now, as we've done over 100 spectrum deals, as we've added significant spectrum from the LEAP transaction, and remember, a lot of LEAP's spectrum was idle in their hands, and we put that to use. We're now taking advantage of that asset that we've always had, those cell sites, that capacity, that density, and just adding spectrum capabilities to it. We believe that that's going to give us an opportunity to accept all this additional data without necessarily some of the build requirements that others have, because we're already ahead of them. Not because we're not going to keep a quality network, but because we're already ahead of them in those counts. And I think that's a really important thing for us.
So I guess we'll talk a bit about wireline.
Yep.
I think it's an area that people tend not to focus on, but it's a big part of your business. And I think specifically regarding so the transition from legacy to strategic, what it means for you sort of managing that process. Clearly, strategic is a growing business. There's a margin differential. And how do you sort of think about the cash flow as you look at wireline and margins?
So if I can use U-verse and the consumer side as an example, once we got U-verse to grow to a specific level, and for U-verse it was about 40% of the overall consumer revenues, the growth rate on that new product and services was strong enough to overcome the legacy losses. And for the last few quarters and last couple of years, you've seen year-over-year growth in our consumer space, even though we have continued pressure on some of the legacy services. That's because we hit that tipping point. We hit that point where the new products and services could outgrow the legacy. And that's been a real improvement. And as we get the VTV deal done, you'll see a real improvement in margins there. If you take that example and go over to the business side, we have about 32-33% of our business revenues that are strategic services. Those strategic services last quarter grew about 15%. If you take into account FX pressure and the SNET sale and so forth, we grew closer to 17%. So as we see those strategic services move up towards that 40% or greater share, and it's been growing 2-3% every quarter, you'll see that same aspect happen that we saw in the consumer side, where the growth rate on these strategic services is going to outpace the pressure that we're getting from legacy. We haven't given a projection or guidance on when we think that's going to happen, but we feel comfortable that we're on the path to get that done. With that, then you get this opportunity to grow margins and to get to scale. One thing you need to be focused on, though, is these new strategic services may not have the initial margins, so when you get to scale and scope, it gives you an opportunity to upsize and upsell much more quickly and much more dramatically. Secondly, they're much more efficient on their capital requirements, less truck rolls, less operational, they're much more software initiated, so there's real opportunity as they scale to grow there. And then as you look at how we've redone the network operations, whether it's network on demand, whether it's software-defined network, whether it's this extensive fiber build, you'll see an opportunity there to improve margins over time. And we do expect that we're going to get back to more traditional 30% wireline margin levels in the future. We've talked about that not in a 15-16 time frame, but after that time frame as Project Agile and the other cost initiatives take effect.
So, and how should we think about enterprise spending? And I know we're going to be resegmenting a lot of things for AT&T post the DirecTV deal. But enterprise in general, you've got FX headwinds, you've got pricing, I think, pressures, you've got some migration of legacy to new. How should we think about the growth rate in a longer-term basis? We used to talk about, I think, GDP plus for the industry, not you guys particularly, but how should we be rethinking that given the current landscape?
So I think a couple of things. One, if you look at the first quarter, I think we're about a 3% negative revenue growth. If you take in adjustments for FX and from non-margin creating products that we walked away from, that was closer to 1.3-1.4%. And in that, we continue to see real interest in people investing in strategic services. So when you hit that tipping point, I think we can go positive, and yes, I think we can grow GDP or GDP plus as people continue to vote for security, for high speed, for quality of strategic services. Would I expect that to happen this year? No. Would I expect it to happen in subsequent years? Yes. Certainly we can grow economy at the GDP level.
So I'm thinking about U-verse, and DirecTV obviously is an important deal for AT&T. Speeds for the broadband consumer, they want more. We're seeing over the top. We're seeing multiple streams on multiple devices. How important is that to the home, and how does DirecTV change the U-verse delivery platform for broadband?
On the U-verse side, I mean, we are offering 75 meg speeds out at almost 100 markets, over 90 markets today. We've got that technology out there. We think that once we get DTV and we can bundle those two things together, it's a really competitive product. And we can make that offering great. So from that perspective, we're on that path. Right now, I think we have over two-thirds of our market gets at 45 meg speeds or better. And we are having good results. We have, 13 million high-speed broadband customers, and we've seen the migration to our high-speed broadband from DSL being significant over the last 3 years. So people want to stay with us, even without, in many cases, a video alternative. Now that we can offer a video alternative, we think that is going to be very good. Now, with that being said, we continue to build out Gigapower in those markets where we believe higher speeds are necessary. We've had great results with that. It's been effective. Customers love the 1 gig product. And we'll just continue to be prudent with all of that.
So, I'm just thinking about speeds over time. Do you think U-verse continues the path? Is there a migration process or to get to something that's akin to, 500 meg per home? Is that an evolutionary, or is it something you need to do to sort of spend more money to get closer to the home on fiber?
Yeah, I wouldn't suggest to you that we have any plans right now to spend a significant amount of capital to get the entire base up to 500 meg speeds. I think it would be more, we would consider more of an evolutionary process.
And then just think about programming costs. You're going to be the biggest pay TV provider in the U.S. Presumably you'll have maybe additional power. I don't know. The programmers seem to have most of the power right now. But thinking about on a going forward basis, how you evaluate the new product set you're going to have, presumably with DTV, whether it's over the top or whatever, or a la carte, do you have more process in that or more negotiation power with the programmers?
Yeah, I think reasonable people can come to reasonable decisions. And when you're sitting there buying 26 million subscriptions every month, you're going to have a different seat at the table than you did when you're buying six. When you are one of the largest advertising companies in the world and the content guys get a lot of your advertising dollars for sports and other programs, you got a different seat at the table. And when you've got the 75 million postpaid customers, wireless, and 50 million broadband customers, capabilities that don't have video subscriptions, you got a different distribution opportunity for them. And you're a company that, while we have a lot of content, we wouldn't necessarily be considered head-on competitors with some of the studios and major networks. saw it being said, I'm real optimistic about being able to, you know, work through a process that says we can negotiate and come to a positive resolution that's good for everybody. And we feel real optimistic about that.
So I think we'll move on to the favorite topic, dividends, cash flow. You know, I think an area of concern for some, not ours, but we do hear that quite a bit. And thinking about sort of you know, the pressures you have now, EIP is a headwind. You've got VIP spending coming down. Is the CapEx level appropriate? And as you go forward with DirecTV, it seems like there's a significant cash opportunity there. If you can just sort of walk through all the puts and takes as you go through the next year or so.
Yeah, so first and foremost, feel very good about the dividend. You know, it's not something that keeps me up at night, to say the least. And we're very comfortable, very confident. It's a board decision. Board's got a 31-year record on what they view. You can imagine that we plan for, in line with the historical decisions of the board, they'll decide. But I feel extremely good about it. Secondly, if you think about free cash flow, and you think about 2014, let's take it head on, and we had free cash flow of about $10 billion in a year when we spent $21.5 billion in CapEx, an unusually large amount so that we could take our entire networks to the next generation. And now we're going to go moderate to a more normal level. That $3.5 billion would add reduction that we're talking about in CapEx. It's going to add straight to cash flow. That's one. Two, there's a lot of trailing expense that goes along with that, a significant amount of trailing expense that goes along with that. That's going to go not only to EBITDA, but to cash flow. That's going to be a second improvement. Third, think back about the EIP investment we made last year and the fact that we invested in our customers almost $5 billion or around $5 billion last year. Think about that and what impact it had on free cash flow last year. If you put those back into perspective, you come up with a much different picture of the strength of our balance sheet and the strength of our free cash flow. You come up with much different coverage metrics. Now, are we going to have last year's level of CapEx spending this year? No. It's going to go down. We're going to have improvement in free cash flow, improvement in trailing expense. Are we going to continue to have some pressure compared to normal on EIP? Yes, but it will ebb from last year. Last year was the first year of the program. That pressure was the strongest. Those customers who signed up last year are going to start paying us monthly basis this year. And so, yes, we'll have more sales this year, but we'll also have all the monthly revenues coming in from last year. Third thing is what do we do with the financing of those and the securitization? And that'll continue on this year. But I feel very good. I think it's very logical to think that our cash flows can improve and our coverage is definitely going to improve. With all that being said, that's all before you close the DirecTV deal, which has strong cash flows, lower capital intensity than us, and will give us dividend coverage that will be an improvement. All you have to do is look at that first quarter free cash flow from DirecTV or the cash balance on their balance sheet as of the end of the first quarter, and you can understand that we feel very positive about where things are going to go with regard to free cash flow, dividend coverage, and our ability to pay down debt.
So I guess, you know, along those lines, thinking about spectrum, and the FCC is talking about a potential, you know, 2016 auction that might take place. How does AT&T evaluate that? And, you know, thinking about the current or the prior auction that just took place, Dish obviously got involved and there's some issues around that. How do you think about going forward? You know, what's your appetite for leverage going into a potential broadcast auction?
So we made some commitments to bid in the auction and a broadcast auction with regard to the initial offer we made on the DirecTV deal. And so I have to see how that comes out and what those are. That was a $9 billion number that was talked about at that point in time. And so you can assume that we would have taken that into account in our planning and I've been very comfortable with our ability to do that and participate. Second, I think you're going to have to see what happens with the broadcast auction. I know there's been discussions from the government representatives that they're very interested in getting it done. But I also know that there's a lot of questions to be answered, not only on the designated entity status, things coming out of the AWS 3 auction, but also, quite frankly, the broadcasters and some of the repacking rules and some of the other terms and conditions that they have. So we're going to have to work through that and see how things go. But we're clearly of the mindset that we're willing to participate. If we can get a national 2x10 footprint, that would be something that would interest us. With that being said, we'll just see how it plays out. We have the capacity. If anyone followed our ability to finance in expectation of the DirecTV deal closing with our U.S. bond market and saw the demand that was out there and the volume and the ability of people, the interest of parties to fund us, it was fairly strong at very, very good rates. So we clearly feel very good about our ability to do that.
I guess we'll end on M&A.
Okay.
And you guys have been active south of the border. Thinking about domestically, we've got a cable deal that was just blocked. I think several deals that may or may not be on the table. Is telecom sort of not involved in what's going on in the process? Would there be an interest in broadband acquisition outside of the AT&T footprint?
Yeah, so kind of from a general viewpoint, M&A, certainly no specific comments on any specific deals. But secondly, we got our hands pretty much full, our plates pretty full with regard to getting the DirecTV deal done. We'll get that done and we'll go through and spend our time evaluating the assets we get, the opportunities we get. Additionally, we got to go through the M&A activity we have done with regard to Mexico and put our attention, our focus, our force, as the team is doing today, on mining the value and creating a great network and mining the process out of that. Additionally, we'll add kind of just one other point. With regard to what the government's decided to do with net neutrality, it has put somewhat of a hamper on the industry, and it's been, it's put some risk in the industry. We, as a company, are still, we've challenged those rules, and we take that activity very, very seriously. We wouldn't challenge those if we didn't have an opportunity to prevail, if we didn't think there was a basis for us to prevail. But whether the litigation or legislation or administrative decisions change, we do expect the net neutrality rules to be redirected, to be reformed. We're going to continue to invest. I wouldn't suggest it's in M&A, but we'll continue to invest here in the United States in the business. We'll take some risks with regard to that. We're in a little different spot that we can do that differently than others. Some of the smaller companies just can't do it with these rules until they're cleared up and clarified. But with regard to all that, that's all part of the process you take into account of what you do next and what you do from a transaction basis. For us, with all those things on our plate, I think you're going to see us focus on ETV, getting it integrated, Mexico, getting those networks built, getting it complete, and figuring out what we have with regard to the additional optionality that we have in Latin America and in Mexico with regard to the DirecTV satellite products.
So, thinking about the current portfolio, are there divestitures that could take place? We saw a recent couple of Verizon deals.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that AT&T is looking at or could potentially do domestically to sort of hive off the portfolio?
Mike, no, I wouldn't suggest there's any specific deal, but I will point this. You've seen us do close to $20 billion worth of asset redirection, so to speak, cash generation over the last 3 years, whether it's the tower sale, whether it's the Yellow Page sale and some of the refinancing that's gone on there, the Connecticut transaction, some real estate we've sold, the American Mobile shares. Whether they're quite $20 billion or close to it, they're a significant amount of money. And with a $300 billion balance sheet, total assets of $300 billion, it's pretty reasonable to assume that we would have an ability, and that I can tell you we feel it is our responsibility to keep scrubbing that asset base and figure out whether there is anything that would be better monetized. We'll continue to do that. There's certainly, as evidenced by our debt issuance, there's a lot of money and a lot of interest in opportunities out there from investors. We just need to kind of continue to go through that process. That's going to be much more of a month-in, month-out process than it is a one-time sales transaction. So I officially, clearly don't want to make any inference or comments to any kind of specific asset sales.
Great. John, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. Thank you all.